So what is the real allure of replacement theology?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, here we are, another thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. You have any Jewish-related questions of any kind, Hebrew-related questions relating to Jesus being the Messiah, questions about Israel, questions about Jewish tradition, give me a call, 866-348-7884. We will catch up on some Israel-related news, and in a few minutes, we're going to dive into the subject of replacement theology. We've talked about this before, but I want to give some of the appeal of replacement theology, why it's often so popular, and I want to do this in the best way possible. In other words, not bashing, not criticizing, but trying to sympathetically ask why replacement theology has so much appeal. If you're not familiar with the term, I'll explain it momentarily. I've had some very nice dialogue with the Palestinian Christian leaders with whom I dialogued in Bethlehem Beit Jala last month and challenged publicly and then debated. One of them did a mini debate, and they've written an article in response to my article, What I Learned at Christ at the Checkpoint. They wrote an article differing with me on certain points, but emphasizing the key thing is that we want to continue to build friendship and interact and listen to one another. So I appreciated their spirit and tone, and maybe at some point I'll interact a little bit more detail with some of what they shared. But we just posted this week the debate that I did with Reverend Dr. Munter Isaac on replacement theology. So it's about an hour long, moderated by Dr. Gary Burge. There was lengthy Q&A afterwards. Then we had to do it a second time for a different audience during a workshop. So we really got to get into these issues back and forth, and I thoroughly enjoyed doing it. So that is on our YouTube channel. So please check it out. I think if you especially enjoy Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, you'll be interested in that. And then last night was our third Real Messiah Jewish Outreach broadcast in New York City. And we have the show. We're doing a live video stream as well. So we have the show on our YouTube channel as well, Ask Dr. Brown. We're really digging into the Hebrew Scriptures. We're really sharing some fascinating insights. We're getting into rabbinic literature and looking at things. I've really enjoyed the shows. I think you'll enjoy them as well. And they're there waiting for you free on our YouTube channel. All right. Replacement theology is technically known as supersessionism, the idea that the church superseded Israel in the salvific plan of God, the idea that the church in some way replaced Israel, or that the church is now Israel, or that somehow promises that were once given to Israel have transferred to the church and no longer belong specifically to Israel. Some call it fulfillment theology, inclusion theology. Those are some of the names that folks use today to say, no, we're not replacement theology, we're fulfillment, we are inclusion theology. Dr. Isaac, or Isaac, that I debated in Bethlehem, said that there's some, he doesn't hold to replacement theology, but there is some redefinition. My point would be the end results are the same. So let's make it real simple. Here's a car lot, all right? New car lot. And you take me into this car lot. There are 100 cars in there. And you say to me, hey, this car is for you. You pick it out. It's a really nice car, brand new. You pick it out. You put my name on it, all right? And you say, hey, listen, whenever you come back, a year from now, 5, 10, doesn't matter. That car is sitting there. That's your car. And it's always going to be your car. And when it gets too old, you just replace it. The newest model, that's your car, period. Signed, Dr. Michael Brown, there it is, that's your car. Now, slice the cake however you want. Call the theology whatever you want. If when I come back to get the car 10 years later, all right, or 50 years later, I'm going to get the newest model of that car, if you say to me, oh, that car now belongs to a lot of other people, you can have it too, but it belongs to a lot of other people. Or you say to me, well, we are all Dr. Michael Brown now. Or Sam Smith over here, he is now Michael Brown. One way or another, the car that was mine, okay, not talking about the other 999 cars, however many are in the lot, or 99 cars out of 100, right? The car that was mine in my name is no longer mine. That would be the effect of replacement theology. Now, when I had a dialogue debate with Dr. Gary DeMar about this, he said, look, this whole idea of replacement is wrong. Let's debunk it to start. And he said, for example, his main argument to start was, let's look at the word ecclesia, translated church in most of our New Testaments. It refers to an assembly, a congregation of people. He said, let's go through the Septuagint. Let's look in the Old Testament translated into Greek. And Israel, the nation of Israel, was called the ecclesia, the congregation, the assembly of Israel. And now you get into the New Testament, and the same term is used, the first Jewish believers, and so on, and then it's everybody. So there's nothing replaced. It's just the ecclesia, which was almost all Israelite at the beginning, is now Israelite and Gentile. Okay, I appreciate that, and I agree with the terminology. The problem is God gave Israel specifically certain promises, not the ecclesia in general, but specific promises to Israel. If those promises no longer end up being given to Israel, for example, the land of Canaan, if it no longer belongs to Israel, then that is one way or another replacement theology. Either the people got replaced, or the object of the promise got replaced, or whatever. Are you with me so far? Again, you've got a question on this or any Jewish-related questions of any kind, 866-348-7884. Now, what are some of the appeals of replacement theology? Why do many believers say, well, we are the new Israel? We are the Israel of God. We are the spiritual Jews. Why do many say that it's not a matter of a land promise anymore, it's a promise of the whole world? We inherit the whole world. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, right? Matthew 5, the Beatitudes, quoting from Psalm 37. Why do people gravitate in this direction? Again, I want to put the best construction on it. I want to look at it in the best possible way. Well, one reason is that there's a deep sense of identification that a Gentile Christian has today with the people of Israel and the history of Israel, that the whole Bible becomes your book. It's not just the book of the Jewish people. It's your book as well. And you can look back to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and in a spiritual way, those are your fathers as well. Now, they're my fathers physically and spiritually. They're your fathers spiritually. But we have that deep sense of connection. And a verse like Galatians 3:29 that tells us if we belong to Messiah, then we are Abraham's seed and heirs according to the promise. So many of the ways that Israel was described in the Old Testament, this is now applied to all believers today. And we have that priestly role in the earth to be teaching the world about God and to be shining like lights. So in many ways, descriptions given to Israel in the Old Testament now apply to all believers today. That's positive. That's wonderful. And in the Messiah, we are equals. In the Messiah, we are equals. I'm no better than you. You're no better than me. A man's no better than a woman. A woman's no better than a man. We are equals in Jesus the Messiah. That's what it means. There's neither Jew nor Greek. There's neither male nor female. There's neither slave nor free. Does Paul imagine now that gender, sex differences don't exist? Does Paul imagine now that there are no such categories as male and female in the world? Of course not. How many times does he address husbands, fathers, men, women, mothers, wives? Of course there are differences. In fact, gender distinctions are beautiful and given by God. We should rejoice in that. But in the Messiah, there's no caste system, no class system. We are equal. So many times people take hold of that equality, but in a way that now forgets the promises that were given specifically to Israel. Many believers are drawn to replacement theology because they say it's all about Jesus. It's not about a land. It's not about people. It's not about race. God's not a racist. God's not ethnocentric. Everything is summed up in Jesus. Of course, everything is summed up in Jesus. But I have a question for you. Does Jesus, the Messiah of Israel, cancel God's promises to Israel or confirm God's promises to Israel. Paul says in Romans 15, verses 8 and 9, that the Messiah confirms the promises to the patriarchs. So the Jewish Messiah coming into the world does not nullify and abolish and cancel promises that God gave to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and the found sheep of the house of Israel. He doesn't cancel those. He confirms them. It's not a matter of racism, not a matter of ethnocentrism. In fact, being called has cost the people of Israel, the Jewish people, dearly. Through our history, we have been severely judged by God. Through our history, Satan and others have tried to wipe us out. It has been very costly. It has nothing to do with ethnocentrism. It has nothing to do with racism. Zionism is racism. It's as false as it is pithy. That is as false as it is pithy. The fact of the matter is, God keeps his promises. Is that so hard for people to understand? God keeps his promises. Nothing to do with favoritism. But if he gives a promise, he keeps it. It's that simple. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. And it is simple. So, again, many Christians are drawn to that which is heavenly, that which is spiritual, and say that transcends the earthly. And I agree, it transcends the earthly, and we live out our lives in this earth in light of eternity and in light of spiritual realities. But let me ask you a question. What if I said to you, well, why are you making a big fuss about justice in your community, that people are not being treated fairly, kids are getting shot in the streets, you're seated in heavenly places, why do you care about that? You go to a funeral where everybody's mourning after a three-year-old kid was hit by a stray bullet, and gang violence or something like that, or here's an instance of police brutality and someone dies or whatever the case might be, and somebody's kid is raped and killed, some horrible thing like that, and people are at the funeral mourning, and you say, what are you getting all upset about? We're seated in heavenly places in Jesus. That would be a travesty. Would you say to a man dying of hunger, hey, Jesus is the bread of life, that's all you need? Well, in the same way, when you tell a Jewish refugee fleeing from persecution to the land of Israel after the Holocaust, and you say, no, Jesus has now become the land of Israel, it's just as insulting, just as irrelevant, and just as wrong. You with me so far? All right, we'll be right back. 866-34-TRUTH.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome to the broadcast. I was about to say welcome, and then the music that always plays that I often forget because it's only on Thursdays. Welcome to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Michael Brown, delighted to be with you. 866-348-7884. I want to say this for maybe the 10,000th time or 100,000th time in my life. Jews need Jesus in order to be saved. There's only one way to get right with God for Jew or Gentile, and that is through the Messiah. So to say promises remain for Israel doesn't mean that any Jewish person is automatically saved. And Paul makes plain in Romans 2, 6 through 11, that blessing comes first for the Jew and also the Gentile, and judgment comes first for the Jew and also for the Gentile. With great privilege comes great responsibility. So again, many Christians drawn to replacement theology because they say, hey, look, it's all about Jesus. We're not preaching a people or a place. Yeah, we preach Jesus. But we don't preach a Jesus that just has some ethereal, non-earthly existence. We preach here. Did the disciples preach about Jesus of Nazareth? Why mention a place? Why even refer to that? And did they dub him Mashiach, Christos, Messiah? That had a very specific meaning. And what's written in Luke's gospel, the promises to Zechariah about John the Immerser, the promises to Miriam about Yeshua, Jesus. What's written there that he is going to bring consolation to Israel and will sit on the throne of David? And what does Peter say in Acts, the third chapter, that Jesus will remain in heaven until the time of the restoration of all things spoken of by the prophets? Look at what the prophets wrote about. Look at what they described. That's going to happen. All right? God's going to keep his word. The Messiah doesn't cancel the promises to Israel. He confirms them. So how does it work out today? Bottom line is that if you hold to any form of replacement theology, God did not bring the Jewish people back to the land. See, there are always tangible consequences to the theology. And the end result here would be that God made these promises and then transferred them to somebody else or spiritualized them or redefined them. To use my car lot analogy, I go back to the car and you say, actually, cars have now been redefined as air. So all the air is yours. Breathe it in. Yeah, I mean, it would be just as ridiculous to say, well, now the whole world, it's been reinterpreted for the whole world. Well, hang on, the Jewish people don't get this tiny little slice in the Middle East. They don't get that. Oh, the whole world. Well, hang on. So you have no problem with the Jewish people coming back to the land? Oh, no, we don't believe that's God. Again, you end up with the same end result, that the Jewish people do not get what was promised. So when you have the opportunity, check out the debate with Dr. Munter Isaac. He is a very literate and eloquent arguer, not arguer, what's the word? Holding, I just blanked out, proponent. That's right, proponent. No, not debater, thanks. Proponent. He's an eloquent proponent of this position. Again, in his mind, it's not replacement theology. In my mind, it is, because you still end up with the same result, okay? The same result. And either you're saying that everybody gets to inhabit the promised land, so 2 billion-plus believers, however many Christians are in the world today, a billion, whatever the number of real believers is, we all inherit that little... No, can't. So in the future, everybody inherits the whole earth, the new heavens and new earth. Okay, great, but what about right now? God gave promises in this world. What about right now? What happens to those promises? Let me just read a quote to you. And guys, this is the second series of slides. R.C.H. Lenski, Richard Lenski, a top Lutheran scholar. And I've often used his commentaries with great profit and really appreciate it. Much of his scholarship. I mean, he wrote commentaries on book after book after book of the whole Bible. So just really a solid commentator that I've greatly learned from, profited from over the years. And Richard Lenski is commenting on Acts, the third chapter, okay? Acts chapter 3. And I'm just going to pull up the quote for myself to read. Acts chapter 3, verse 25. And this is where Peter ties in Jesus, the Messiah, with the blessing of Abraham, all right? So this is where it's all tied in together. And let me just see where I put that. Okay, so Lenski says this. He says that some interpret the promise in Acts 3:25 as if there is going to be blessing that comes to the whole world through the Jewish people. He even makes it into like a multitude of Jewish messiahs or something like that, as if the Jewish people are going to be the savior people, rather than recognize it. And he says, you know, we reject this line of interpretation. Rather than recognizing that Jesus is the seed who brings to fulfillment what God said through Abraham, through his seed the whole world would be blessed. He is the particular seed through whom the whole world is blessed, which then brings blessing to the rest of Abraham's seed, the physical and the spiritual. And it's really very simple. All right, 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to the phones, and we'll start with David in Fort Mill, South Carolina. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I really appreciate your ministry.
Thank you.
I have kind of a technical Hebrew question for you, if you don't mind. It's in regard to the Tetragrammaton, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh.
All right, so I'm just going to jump in here and there so folks are following us. So
sure.
The divine name called the Tetragrammaton, which in Hebrew is the letters Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, so YHWH in English. And there's great debate about how to pronounce the name. Okay, back to you.
Great, thank you. So just want to say, first of all, that I read an article of yours in a book. Well, it was a part of a book called 60 Answers to Questions.
60 Questions Christians Ask About right. Jewish Beliefs and Practices. Yep.
Right, right. So in that article, you answer a question about Jehovah, and I agree with your response to that Jehovah is a result of a Jewish tribal custom.
Mm-hmm.
That is, that it was the vows of Adonai, the Shiva Holam Hametz, that was part of Adonai that is transferred to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way that you have the vows of Elohim, when sometimes Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is pointed for Elohim.
Right, exactly.
Yes, so there are some people that disagree with that. Pretty much the only person I can think of on a scholarly level that disagrees is a guy by the name of Nehemiah Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
And he argues that any time the name shows up with those vowel points, the Shiva Holam Hametz, that it's not a Ketiv Kerei or a perpetual Ketiv Kerei. They're not the vowels of Adonai, but are in fact the correct vocalization of the name. And the reason he argues this is there's a number of ways you can prove that wrong. For instance, prefix prepositions when they're attached to the divine name.
The way they change. There's an article in the Jewish Encyclopedia. Online article, which you can now get if you just search in for the divine names, either Tetragrammaton or Yahweh or Jehovah, however it would be written there. And that will show that even with the Masoretic pointing that we have, the vowels that we have, that yes, it changes in certain ways only based on our understanding that it stood for Adonai. And based on the Nehemiah Gordon way of understanding, it doesn't work. So that's pretty easily refuted, as you just mentioned.
Right. Right. Yeah. So in the Aleppo Codex and the Leningrad, the scribes obviously are pointing Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh as Adonai. Well, Nehemiah responded to this recently in some video, and he pointed to a number of manuscripts from the 11th to 12th century, where the scribes did not follow those rules. So, for example, usually when a preposition is attached to a word beginning with yod, the shiva drops and combines with the kirik vowel of the preposition. Well, in the instances of the manuscripts that Nehemiah points to, it doesn't do that. The yod retains the shiva vowel, and the preposition attached is a patak, but the yod retains the shiva. And Nehemiah argues that proves that these are the vowels of the actual vowels of the Tetragrammaton, how it's supposed to be vocalized, even though the vowels on the prepositions indicate that it should be said Adonai.
Got it. Yeah. So, David, I haven't seen that argument from him or those manuscripts, but the Aleppo Codex was considered the jewel of the oldest manuscripts that we had. Part of it was burnt in a fire in Aleppo, Syria, but it has been cherished and protected. And the Leningrad, the B19A Leningrad manuscript, is another authoritative one. So they're also from different locations, original provenances, as I understand. So as far as I know, this reflects the massive, massive, massive constant example. And then you also have vocalization from other traditions outside of the Tiberian tradition. As far as I know, they all back this up. Stay right there, though, David. Thank you.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome, friends, to The Line of Fire. Michael Brown here. Delighted to be with you on this thoroughly Jewish Thursday. Okay, special announcement. Everyone listening, watching, tuning in the greater Nashville, Tennessee area. Tomorrow night, 6 to 9 p.m., I'm scheduled to debate Dr. Theodore Zacharias on the question, have the gifts of the Spirit ceased according to the New Testament? Are they for today according to the Bible? We're going to be debating that. There is a small charge to register. The organizers needed to do that in order to have funds to do the debate. All the information is on my website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Just look there in itinerary, and hopefully you'll be able to join me tomorrow night. We do hope to have a videotape of the event available afterwards, but by all means, do your best to get out if you're anywhere in the area. So how do we pronounce the name of God? On the one hand, it's not a problem that it's shrouded in mystery. It reminds us of God being above us and beyond us. The idea that we refer to him as Lord over 6,000 times in the Hebrew Bible, capital L, then small caps O-R-D, that masks the fact that the actual name, most likely Yahweh, and traditionally but incorrectly Jehovah, is being used there. But there are a number of layers of explanation as to how we come up with the interpretation and pronunciation and say most likely Yahweh, and here's why we say it's not Jehovah. But this much we know, it is who God is that matters most. It is how he has revealed himself that matters most. And his name ties in with his covenant-keeping nature. His name ties in with who he is and what he does. And when he reveals himself to Moses in Exodus 3 and says, Eheyeh asher eheyeh, I am who I am, or I will be who I will be, or I am who I will be. I mean, I don't think it means all the above, but just saying there are different ways it could be translated. And then say, I am has sent me to you. There is a degree of mystery and majesty along with a covenant-keeping aspect of God saying, I will faithfully perform that which I promised. 866-348-7884. You've got Jewish-related questions. We've got Jewish-related answers. We go to Redding, California. Robert, welcome to The Line of Fire.
Hey, are we still talking about... Hi, Dr. Brown. Are we still
replacement theology? Go for it, man. Yes, sir.
Okay, I've been studying it. I definitely believe that replacement theology is a false doctrine. I've studied it for years and years. And in talking to replacement theologists, here, the biggest problem that I've found is there is an amazing, unbelievable amount of pride Christians have towards the Jewish people. And it's based on pride. They want to feel superior to the Jewish people or whatever it is. And that's just my thing. And also, there's this misconception that when a lot of Gentiles, it's okay to use that term, when they read the Bible, they automatically, they read all this stuff about the Jews, they think, oh, well, God loves the Jews more. And so in order for me to be loved by God equally, I have to become a part of Israel. And that's a total misconception. You can be French, Russian, Japanese, whatever, and God loves you just as much. Okay? Now, God has a unique role for the Jewish people, and that the Messiah will come through the Jewish, well, he already has, come through the Jewish people, and all these things. But God loves everybody just as much, so Christians need to stop this feeling of needing to become Jewish.
Yes. Here's what's going on, Robert. In the first half hour of the program today, I was talking about replacement theology and putting the best construction on things and saying that here's why many are drawn to it. But there's the other side, which is the insecurity. The other side, which says, well, if God still has promises for Israel, then if I'm a Gentile believer, what am I, chopped liver or second class or second rate? And again, most everyone says this, secure in their own homeland. And we say, well, don't the Jewish people get a homeland? And people are up in arms over it. Why be up in arms over it? Look, the fact of the matter is, what Paul says in Romans 11 to the Gentile believers is look at how you have benefited. Look at the mercy that's been shown to you. Now you show mercy back to Israel. And tragically, that hasn't happened. So the reason we make such a big deal about replacement theology is the fruit of it has led to the destruction of Jewish people through the centuries and paved the way for the Holocaust without question. And today, it fuels the fires of those who say that Israel does not have a right to the land today or that God has not brought the Jewish people back to the land. So, yes, in many cases, there's an insecurity. There's a competition. And look, you know, when you do well and you get commended for it, you know, hey, Robert, great job, really proud of you. And then maybe your best friend does well, too. Like, you win your race, you know, in high school, and he wins his race, and you're both all excited, and everybody's happy. But if he wins his race and you lose your race, then you're like, you always win. You know, people get bad attitudes. So a lot of it does stem from insecurity. But Paul addresses it explicitly head on in Romans, the 11th chapter. He addresses it head on. And there he says, I don't want you to be ignorant lest you become arrogant. So what's the ignorance? The ignorance is God's finished with Israel. We're the new Israel. God's kicked them out and taken us in. That ignorance leads then to that obvious arrogance, and that brings judgment. So to the extent the church has fallen into that, it has fallen away from grace and fallen away from favor and blessing. And one other thing, the term Gentile can be a negative term, pagan, people of the nations that worship idols, etc. And Paul says, you know, to the Ephesians, don't live the way Gentiles live. But some say the text should really read, don't live the way other Gentiles live. But we know in Romans 11, Paul uses it in the most positive terms, people of the nations. I'm writing to you Gentiles in as much as I'm the apostle to the Gentiles. And I'm writing to you Gentiles that you'll make my people Israel envious. So there's nothing negative. There's nothing derogatory. Jew is not superior. Gentile is not inferior. We're all equal in the Messiah. But the world needs here. The harvest has to go through the whole world, the fullness of the Gentiles, this gospel of the kingdom being preached to all nations. The end comes. And Israel turning to the Messiah. These are two things of great importance to God. So Robert, often I've seen the very same thing. I wanted to put the best construction on things earlier and to say that people can hold to this wrong theology for spiritual reasons, but they can also hold to it for unspiritual reasons. Friends, if you've never read my book, Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, read it and you'll see why I make such a big deal about this. Hey, Robert, thank you so much for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. So let's go to Birmingham, Alabama. Courtney, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I have two questions. One's going to kind of piggyback off of David's question. I'm sure that you have heard of Dr. M.D. Coogan.
Who?
M.D. Coogan, C-O-O-G-A-N. He wrote Patterns in Jewish Personal Names in the Babylonian Diaspora. Basically, he kind of starts to notice that there are patterns in Jewish names that begin, you know, there's people that say that the name, you know, is pronounced one way versus another way, and I don't think we'll ever really know until we're actually physically told by the Messiah himself. But nevertheless, one of the things that comes to mind is that the beginning of the name could be Y-A-H as opposed to Y-E-H. But because we know that the ending of the name ends with, like, Eliyahu. Well, what he showed was in the patterns, their names, when they would come back, their names would actually have the Y-A-H pronunciation as opposed to the Y-E-H. which is where you get some people say Yeshua's name is more like Yeshua. So there's one question. And then another question, really fast.
All right, so hang on. I was having a hard time hearing the name when you were giving it to me. So just please give me the author's name one more time.
Coogan, M.D. Coogan.
Oh, okay.
Patterns in Juke.
All right, got it. Okay, sure. Got it. Okay.
And you can it's like an 8-page, so I have it, and you can sign up for a free viewing. And if you want to, you can pay for it, but you can actually sign up for it to get it free online. And I actually sent that to Nehemiah Gordon himself, just to kind of
I didn't hear the name. Yeah, he's a well respected Old Testament, Ancient Near Eastern scholar. Sure.
Uh-huh. So I thought that was quite interesting, because I know there's lots of debate whether it's Yahuwah or Yahweh or Jehovah.
Well, there's no debate about Yahuwah. The name does not exist. There's no debate. And there's no debate about Yeshua. It doesn't exist. These are just myths. There's no Hebrew scholar that knows anything. That's a legitimate Hebrew scholar that's going to argue that the name was ever Yeshua. Never been. There's no precedent for it anywhere in Hebrew. Ends of names are different than beginnings of names. There's all kinds of things, what's called hypocoristic theophoric onomastica, so shortened forms of names that have divine elements in them, the way they change. I had to do a whole comparative study of this as part of my dissertation to look for names with Rapha elements in them in Hebrew and then in other ancient languages. But, the fact is, changing in names and pronunciation and dialects and things, that's going to happen through history. No one would argue that. But it doesn't play in. It would have to be someone misunderstanding that then comes away with Yahuwah or something like that, or Yahshua. It would have to be some misunderstanding of the arguments that they're making. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does. I guess it was interesting because what he found in the patterns in Jewish personal names in the Babylonian diaspora seemed to indicate that there was more to the pronunciation of those who had his name in their name than what we're seeing today.
So again, just because I had studied, again, what's called theophoric onomastica being these names, and theophoric meaning it has the divine element in it, and hypocharisticon, that would just be shortened, like nickname forms. But the way the names of God or gods in the ancient world can morph and change once they're part of a name does not give you an indication as to how to pronounce that divine name. That's the point. But thank you for a very important literate question. I appreciate it.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
מן השעות והשניות והקולות באוזניות מן הכוכב על המגדל.
Thanks for joining us, friends, on The Line of Fire. If you missed our Wednesday night Jewish outreach broadcast, The Real Messiah, which blankets New York City on WMCA and then goes worldwide on live stream on internet, we have the show up. I think you'll be fascinated as we dug into this week's Torah portion with some really interesting messianic insights that is available at our YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown, Ask Dr. Brown. Okay, just some Jewish-related news, and then we are going to go back to the phones. There's an article on the Wall Street Journal. Younger evangelicals waver in support for Israel. Generational split reflects concern over Palestinian spurring outreach by some churches and groups. Now, the article is from June, so earlier, June 3rd of this year. So it's just a couple weeks old. But that's nothing new. That's not new news. We've known this for quite a few years. We've known it for quite a few years. And it's due primarily to two things, as I can see it. One is lack of Bible knowledge among many folks growing up today, not being raised with solid knowledge of Scripture. That's one. Two, Israel-bashing reporting that makes Israel into the bad guy and the Palestinians as the helpless victims. And of course, young people with their heart for justice are going to side with the Palestinians based on the way things are being reported, not necessarily based on realities on the ground. So no surprise there, but definitely something to be concerned about. We've known this for many years, though. There's nothing new in that report. I'm not saying they shouldn't have written it. Also, some more news. You may have heard during the Hamas-sponsored and Hamas-inspired protests trying to violently cross the border into Israel from Gaza and then sending in these kites, incendiary kites, kite bombs so that they land over farms and then start blazes and things like that and just doing whatever damage is possible. One Hamas leader said, we're going to go into Israel and tear the hearts out of the Israelis. So among the casualties, among the many Palestinian casualties, was a baby 8 months old, and everyone outraged. What, the baby died of tear gas? What kind of monsters are these? What is Israel doing? Well, here's an article in Jerusalem Post. Hamas paid family to say IDF killed 8-month-old baby with tear gas. According to the testimony, the baby died of a blood disease. Do you hear that? Right from the start, people said, wait a second. Why is a mother near protests where there's tear gas and there's gunfire? What's she doing there with her baby? That's question number one. And then immediately reports started to come out. No, the baby didn't die of tears. There's some other condition. The baby was sick before. So now it's come out that Hamas chief Yahya Sinwar paid the Al-Ghandur family to say that their 8-month-old baby, Layla, died of gas inhalation from tear gas used by the IDF. Yeah, how miserable, how monstrous. But this is what Hamas will do. I'm not saying that everything Israel does in Gaza is right. I'm not saying Israel is blameless. I'm saying Hamas is the terrorist group, not Israel. And this is the type of stuff that they do to try to make Israel look bad. Watch how many reports there were about that baby dying of Israeli tear gas. False report. And then check to see how many retractions there are. Standard. And then last thing, UN leaving Human Rights Council, Nikki Haley has spoken out, and I am glad the U.S. has left. It has been called now by America a cesspool of political bias. And bottom line is this. One simple fact, the UN Human Rights Council, just like the UN General Assembly or Security Council, they all follow in the same pattern, condemns Israel more than all other nations on the earth combined. Outrageously. For a couple years running, a human rights women's organization, when it meets, has issued condemnations. They'll issue a report about the state of women in the world and then only condemn and attack one nation, Israel. Out of all. And you go to Israel, you're not going to find a more progressive, woman-friendly country. So it's some of the craziness. I'm glad we have to send a message. No more of this junk. No more of this nonsense. We're not going to have it. Good for President Trump. Good for Ambassador Nikki Haley. When they do right, I will shout it from the rooftops. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, we go back to the phones. Russell in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I got to say, I watched your debate with Dr. Isaac the other day, and I found it fascinating on so many levels. I mean, you're a messianic believer, the Palestinian, Christian, and both with such academic credentials and coming from your own perspective, I really, really appreciated that.
Yeah, and just for those who are not familiar with this, so Reverend Dr. Munter Isaac, or Isaac, I kept calling him Isaac, but it's Isaac, is a Palestinian Christian leader, PhD from Oxford University, and basically a replacement theology PhD. He would not call it replacement theology. So we did a debate. They invited me to be part of a workshop where we do a mini debate and then have Q&A with the audience. So He went about 14 minutes. I went about 14 minutes. Then we went back and forth with some rebuttals. Dr. Gary Burge, highly respected New Testament scholar, but also very, very strong replacement theologian. He moderated, and I got to spend some good time with Dr. Burge while there as well, which was great. So this is on our YouTube channel, Ask Dr. Brown, A-S-K-D-R Brown. Check it on YouTube. Replacement Theology, Dr. Michael Brown debates Dr. Munter Isaac. Of course, it's on our digital library at AskDrBrown.org. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I told him afterwards, I felt close to him afterwards. You know, it's almost like two boxers and they hug at the end. And so I really enjoyed it. What did you find most interesting from your viewpoint?
Well, I was wondering if you felt like maybe some of the differences between yourself and Dr. Isaac kind of boiled down to his filtering of your arguments through a kind of presentist lens. I mean, the debate was over what the scriptures say about the role of Israel and the church and things like that. You know, but for example, at the end, you said that, you know, in order to inherit the promises that are specific to Israel, I think, you know, either himself or the moderator asked you, you know, what are some of these specific promises that are, you know, only given to Israel? And you said, well, the land. But that in order to kind of come into that they, you know, someone would need to take on the signs of the covenant, like circumcision or something like that.
Right. If he was saying, hey, if I believe in the God of Israel, then I'm part of then I'm Israel, I'm part of Israel. Yeah, and I said, well, then are you circumcised? In other words, if you're the physical part of Israel. Yeah, a lot of it came down to present realities. And to be honest, Russell, I debated whether to bring up the land promises or not, because the whole replacement theology argument through history, most of the time the land of Israel was not in question, was not an issue. Jewish people were scattered around the world, and there was no possibility of a regathered state of Israel. You know, no one was countenancing that. And replacement theology was ugly and wrong and destructive because it took away the spiritual promises from Israel or took away the distinct peoplehood of Israel or whatever else it might be. But I felt we had to have something tangible. You know, we had to flesh it out and have something tangible. And that's exactly what this was. This was the tangible thing that caused the real differences, because ultimately that's what it came down to. And again, I'm not saying this to prejudice the argument one way or another. Folks will watch. But I was looking to see how much of the debate we had. Do we have the Q&A? So I was skipping around to some parts and went towards a discussion at the end. And the question comes up, okay, so do the 2 million professing Christians inherit the physical land of Israel? And he was saying, no, I'm not saying that. And I said, well, you keep, you know, wanting this land. He goes, I'm saying that as a Palestinian. As a Palestinian Christian. So there was that aspect of what about us Palestinians? And in sympathy to Dr. Isaac would be the fact that they see Christians supporting Israel. They feel Israel is oppressing them and mistreating them. They are the Christians. Israel is not a believing nation. Why are the Christians and the rest of the world standing with Israel and neglecting them? And that's where they feel a certain tension. And in my talk, which you can see online as well, a loving challenge to my Palestinian Christian friends, one of the points I made was you're not going to have the sympathy of many Christians in the West if you hold to any form of replacement theology, because we know that the God who scattered the Jewish people is the God who brought the Jewish people back. And there's no two ways about it. If he scattered us in his judgment, the nations of the world don't have the power to regather us. The UN doesn't have the power to regather us. The British mandate doesn't have the power to regather us. The Balfour Declaration doesn't have the power to regather us. The Peel Commission doesn't have the power to regather us. Doesn't matter who, the United Nations, Russia, nobody has the power to regather us if God scattered us. So he brought us back. And for those who say, but you only return, you can only come back with repentance. Yeah, that's according to the Sinai Covenant. But the promise to Abraham was given centuries earlier. And Paul says in Galatians 3:17, the law which comes later can't nullify the promise. So God brought us back in unbelief because he's merciful, because it's his reputation involved, because he has a plan. We all fail and fall short under the law, but we live by mercy and grace. So let us pray for God's best for the Palestinians, especially Palestinian Christians. And let us pray for God's purposes for Israel. All right, back with you. You've got questions. We've got answers tomorrow.